You're listening to the World Weekly Review. I'm your host and producer, Skidmark Bob. Here we share important news stories from around the world via news sources like Al Jazeera English, along with other independent audio news. Please stay tuned.
Then I want you off eating! Then I want you off eating!
First, we're going to hear about the civilian suffering going on in Sri Lanka.
Young and old, women and children trapped together in the same nightmare. This video, sent to Al Jazeera by Tamil sources, shows what is supposed to be a no-fire zone, an area to keep civilians safe as war rages around them. But the war is here too. It's everywhere. Medics say that in the last 2 days, 28 civilians have been killed and more than 160 wounded. Tamil sources put the death toll much higher, at over 150 dead on Saturday and more than 200 injured. Whatever the true figure, there is little help available for these people. The war echoes in their wounded eyes and broken bodies, their rattles of pain. The United Nations estimates 100,000 civilians are still trapped here. Conditions are cramped, facilities sparse, and hunger is creeping towards mass starvation. International human rights groups accuse the Tamil Tigers of using civilians as human shields and the government of disregarding civilian safety in its drive to destroy its enemy. Both sides deny these accusations, but international concern is growing. Tamil protesters in southern India show frustration that their government is not doing more for its neighbours. Britain has sent a special envoy to the UN to demand action. The US is in talks with the Sri Lankan government, trying to bring about a ceasefire. But this is a war Colombo has been fighting for 25 years. On Thursday, the president made his first visit to what he calls the newly liberated land, bringing a clear message: the government will not give up now. So with both sides refusing to back down and diplomacy failing, the suffering of civilians will only get worse. Lucy Keating, Al Jazeera.
Let's go to Haiti now, where Secretary of State Hillary Clinton just visited, promising more aid.
These workers are producing clothes for export to the United States. It's part of a U.S. initiative to help the Western Hemisphere's poorest nation. And this time, they want to get it right. Factories like this one are taking advantage of U.S. legislation known as the HOPE Act that allows Haitian textiles to enter the U.S. tax-free. These people make about $5 a day, 2 times Haiti's minimum wage, enough to put some food on the table, but not to get people out of poverty.
No. I can only afford transport and some food with what I make. Nobody cares about us. We're used to being ignored.
Haiti desperately needs jobs, and factories like this one could help this country fight unemployment. But many fear that the low wages being paid here could turn Haiti into the sweatshop of the United States. The factory's manager says he cannot afford to pay more.
The HOPE legislation helps the customer that is in the United States. We get very little money, but they can resell it all over the world. I think we are helping the U.S. instead of them helping us.
For many, the textile initiative is not solving one of Haiti's main problems, a food shortage. 60% of Haiti's population lives in rural areas, but the country imports over half of the food it consumes. In the Artibonite Valley, the government is trying to help the agricultural sector, but these farmers say they need more assistance.
There is no water. It's hard to get seeds. It's very difficult for us.
Hunger is everywhere here. These people are scavenging the leftovers of the rice harvest. This is the only food they have to feed their families for the day. Poverty in Haiti has fueled political and social instability here for years. On her way to the summit of the Americas, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton visited Haiti and pledged her country support.
I announce that the United States will provide $287 million in aid this year, consistent with the priorities outlined by the Haitian government.
The money will be destined to help with jobs, roads, and agriculture. In the afternoon, Clinton visited one of the garment factories. There, she brought a message of hope.
All the people of Haiti need now is the opportunity to work.
And the good news was missed on most of the Haitians in the crowd because the speech was translated in French, not Creole, the language that the poorest Haitians speak. But they have heard promises by politicians before and have yet to see them materialize.
Thank you all very much.
Teresa Wu, Al Jazeera, Port-au-Prince.
And now we'll be hearing about the struggle for survival for Kenya's cattle owners.
Forced to flee by a severe drought, in Kenya's desolate and semi-arid northeast, hundreds of pastoralist families are on the move. Some are seeking pasture and water for their livestock, their livelihood. But for others like this family, the drought has already decimated their wealth.
The drought has been long. Our goats and cattle became weak and we had to abandon them. We have no food, no money. You can imagine the problems of someone who has no job and who also has lost his livestock.
The way of life of these people has now changed dramatically. With no livestock to look after, they have been forced into a settled life in Melakisi village. It is a reality facing many in northeastern Kenya today. The region has suffered from the failure of four consecutive rainy seasons. Everywhere, as far as the eye can see, the trees have shriveled up. Even the normally drought-resistant acacia has had no chance. And this has been the fate of the livestock. Too weak to move, then abandoned. It will either die here of hunger and thirst or be eaten by wild animals. Even for those with more resilient livestock like camels, the drought has taken its toll. This Hada lets his camels drink from a puddle in the road. It is a struggle, as the animals have had no water for days.
These people have chosen to come and settle here because it is one of the few places where they can get water and the occasional supply of food aid by either the government or aid agencies. They're just part of 1.2 million in this region alone who've been affected by the drought.
But food aid is not guaranteed here. With new arrivals increasing by the day, aid agencies say they are stretched. Sarura Abdi came to the village 1.5 months ago. She's yet to receive any relief.
We survive on what I'm given by my neighbors, who are registered with the agencies. They give us part of their share of food.
And aid workers are warning of even tougher times ahead.
In the current rainy season, if it doesn't rain well in the next few days or weeks, the situation will go worse. And animals are already weak and emaciated. And the people's livelihood might be lost again once more.
Rain, no doubt, is the key to this community's survival. But when it finally arrives, it will be too late for some.
Once their livestock has perished, and for some, it has come to that already. That means that is the end of their life as nomads. They then have to come to villages and major towns and settle there as peasants, waiting for government's help, or the government's help, or non-governmental organizations bringing them food aid from time to time. But this is nothing that can that they can continue to live on for a long time. Some of the people we've been speaking to say that the non-governmental organizations usually register the needy, and whenever they go back and bring food for those that they had registered, there are already hundreds or thousands of others who have already joined, and there are always at a given time those who have gone hungry. And it is the breakdown in the livelihoods of these people that is creating so much problem, because it means these people have to live in a life of poverty for generations. If their only hope then would be their children, who would have to go to school and then go through the school system, and if they're lucky, get jobs. And that would take many, many years.
For more information or to watch video of these news stories, visit the Al Jazeera English YouTube page or visit english.aljazeera.com. Net.
Well, in northwestern Pakistan, thousands have rallied to celebrate the implementation of stricter Sharia or Islamic law in the Swat Valley. The rally in Mingora was led by Sufi Muhammad, one of the most influential religious leaders in the region. He mediated the deal that saw the government accept Sharia in Swat Valley in exchange for peace with the Pakistani Taliban there. Now, some of the residents are hoping it will bring about a change for the better.
Pakistani Taliban fighters secure the gates to the mosque as the locals prepare for prayers. Others walking casually with their guns on their shoulders. While many fighters from neighboring Swat have come and gone, others have stayed on in Bunair and have won over the locals. This small valley was once part of Swat, is dotted by villages home to almost 500,000 inhabitants. Support for the implementation of Sharia is widespread here, and people want a similar system to be put in place.
We, the people of Bunair, welcome the implementation of Sharia law and pray for its success. And we accept this law by all means.
In the far-flung corners of the northwest frontier province, there is no administration at all. The police is corrupt, the government inefficient. No wonder the people are supporting the Taliban.
Walking through the thick brush, the Pakistani Taliban shows the spot where the body was buried. She was killed by her older brother after she threatened to tell the Taliban about him selling her into slavery. The Taliban have since arrested the murder suspects and are waiting for further orders from their leaders. Such acts have endeared the Pakistani Taliban to ordinary people who cannot dream of justice in a land embroiled in violence and with outmoded and age-old systems that have failed.
People are fed up of the current judicial system as it has failed to provide justice.
The poor say that if they are unable to get justice from the government, they will seek it from the Pakistani Taliban.
Just a few days back, Bunair was in the headlines, and that because the Taliban from Swat spread into this territory. Ever since that, they have been in this area. They're telling the people that they want to implement Sharia law in this particular territory at a time when the government has relented and given those rights to the people of Malakand and Swat. The big question for the government will be, will it go beyond Swat and Malakand, or will it just stop there? Kamal Haider, Al Jazeera, Bunair.
Around 1,000 soldiers from China, Russia and Central Asia are taking part in war games in Tajikistan, showing off the capabilities of what some say could become the NATO of the East. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization says it's particularly concerned about the threat of an unstable Afghanistan. Robin Forestieri-Walker reports from the Tajik capital, Dushanbe.
Battlefield simulations in 21st century Central Asia. This is the military manifestation of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or SCO. Fighting units take back control of a strategic installation and a hijacked aeroplane. Terrorists have taken hostages and used biological or chemical weapons. Tajik infantrymen and special forces are complemented by units from Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan and Russia. The SCO is a regional alliance that also includes China and Uzbekistan. It's been meeting in Dushanbe this week to consider approaches to counter-terrorism and insurgency.
The vast majority of forces in this operation come from the host nation, Tajikistan. It shares a border with Afghanistan, just a few hundred kilometers to the south, and it's from there that the perceived threat emanates.
SCO members have identified what instability in Afghanistan means to them, from heroin production to a haven for regional separatist groups. Some observers have suggested that the SCO serves as a block to counter Western interests in the region. But the SCO's willingness to engage with Afghan instability appears to be appreciated by the Americans, who were invited to watch the display.
I think anytime the international community comes together to help combat terrorism, it's a good thing.
Originally, the SCO was formed to resolve border disputes between the Chinese and the newly independent Stans following the breakup of the Soviet Union. The SCO's agenda broadened to include energy and trade. Now others are considering joining the club, including Pakistan, India and Iran. These choreographed drills show the SCO nations can coordinate a unified response to regional security, in theory. But the SCO is a work in progress, and its members have as many internal disagreements as they have shared interests. The idea that it might one day become a NATO of the East is, for now, just an idea. Robin Forestier-Walker for Al Jazeera, Dushanbe, Tajikistan.
And you're listening to the World Weekly Review. And now we move to occupied Iraq now. Story about death squads that haunt Iraqi victims.
Nestled amongst the memories and headstones, one woman tends to a grave. Sabadia comes to this Baghdad cemetery every Friday without fail to visit her husband. She is one of thousands of people whose lives were torn apart by sectarian violence, which almost brought Iraq to the brink of civil war. She and her husband were kidnapped, tortured, and her husband then killed in cold blood.
2 years and a half ago, we were visited his brother in Shaab area. On leaving, we were kidnapped by militias, put on as a police uniform. They kidnapped me with my husband. For 8 days, we were with them. They tortured him severely. The reason behind our kidnapping is because he is Sunni and I am Shia. They tortured him severely in front of me.
She is still angry at the men that took her husband's life.
I don't know how kind of people they were. I don't know how they felt. They are not human. The word human is not suitable. They are savages. They are, I don't know what kind of people they are.
The pain of her ordeal is still fresh, and as she prays, the cemetery carries on its business. This is Nasser, an undertaker here. Through the worst excesses of the Iraq war, he buried countless victims, young and old, male and female. He even buried his own father, one more victim of the invasion of Iraq.
In 2007,
we witnessed many deaths caused by sectarian violence. We used to bury around 13 martyrs every day in this graveyard. Sometimes the figure would go up to 20 martyrs. We now bury people killed by car bombs, an average of one person per month. We hope no more attacks will take place.
This cemetery remains busy, and although many analysts believe the worst of Iraq's violence is now over, it could, they say, have been avoided by better post-war planning. But planning means little here. Amongst the names and pictures are lives destroyed, families heartbroken and left to fend for themselves. Whatever studies that will come to pass, however scientifically they work out how people died, the question for Iraqis will always be why. Why did their loved ones have to die? Imran Khan, Al Jazeera.
After 4 months of political wrangling, Iraq's parliament has a new speaker. It's now been decided that Ayad al-Samarai, a strong critic of Prime Minister al-Maliki, will replace former speaker Mahmoud al-Mashhadani. He resigned in December last year following complaints of erratic behaviour. In the north of the country, security is being threatened by a power struggle between the Kurdish regional government and Baghdad. The Kurdistan regional government controls three areas, Duhok, Erbil and Sulaymaniyah. It's a semi-autonomous region with its own parliament and army. But the Kurds want to expand their territory to incorporate a 300-kilometre-long strip of land they said should be part of the Kurdish homeland. The real prize is the city of Kirkuk, a region that sits on some of the richest oil reserves in the country. The Kurds want it, and so does central government. Mahmir is a town in the disputed territory which is 90% Kurdish and wants to be part of the KLG. This area is meant to be under the control of Iraqi forces, but here the Kurdish Peshmerga troops roam freely. Zina Khoda travelled with them to see them at work.
The Peshmerga are in charge of security in areas under the authority of the Kurdistan Regional Government in northern Iraq. The Kurdish armed forces are not supposed to operate in areas outside KRG control, but in this region, south of Erbil, they do. Iraqi soldiers, in this case Kurds, don't prevent them from crossing the unofficial border. This is one of the biggest problems between Arabs and Kurds in Iraq, demarcating the border. Now, beyond this checkpoint to the south is disputed territory, and the Kurds would like to include it in their semi-autonomous region. The district of Mahmur lies in the province of Mosul. Constitutionally, disputed areas should be under the control of Iraq's central government, pending a long-delayed referendum to decide whether they join the KRG or Baghdad. Arabs and Kurds have been accusing each other of trying to undermine their authority in disputed territories. But Kurds here deny they are expanding their reach.
There is no Peshmerga here. The Iraqi army is the only security force present.
Despite what the mayor says, the Peshmerga escorted us into the area. They appear to be a force on the ground. Some Arabs here, however, accuse the KRG of creating new facts on the ground.
It is the Peshmerga that are in charge of Mahmur. The Kurds are in control. The Iraqi army is not really here.
Mahmur is a mainly Kurdish populated area, and for them, becoming a part of the KRG is their right.
I was forced to leave my home during Saddam's rule. I came back in 2003, and I want to be part of the KRG. I don't trust Baghdad.
It is relatively peaceful here. Kurds wanted to stay that way, and believe the government should hold a referendum to avoid tensions and preserve unity.
We will declare independence if they don't respect our rights.
The competition over power and territory has already become a violent struggle in other regions like Mosul and Diyala, and it may just prove to be the biggest threat to long-term stability in northern Iraq. Sana Khudr, Al Jazeera, Mahmur.
And now we move to occupied Palestine. We're going to start off with the West Bank. Palestinians mourn demonstrators' death,
laying to rest one of their own. The village of Bilayin mourns the death of Bassem Abu Rahme, killed while protesting against Israel's West Bank separation wall. It divides Bilayin in two, with Palestinians on both sides and Israeli settlers not too far off. The tragic final minutes of Bassem's life are by now well known. Bassem particularly stood out. His friends affectionately called him the elephant because of his imposing frame. But it was not enough to repel the long-distance tear gas canister fired at his abdomen from a very close and lethal range. Those who attend the weekly demonstration say Israel has increased the use of force against unarmed activists, and these high-powered tear gas canisters are to blame. Mohammed Khatib knows it well. He insisted that doctors give him the munition as evidence of Israel's brutality.
If you read here, written in Hebrew, that it's for far distance, which is it can reach 500 meters. It works like a rocket.
This is the second time Mohammed has seen Israel shoot tear gas canisters directly at civilians. In March, the Israeli military fired one at a visiting American activist. It punctured his forehead, and he has yet to regain consciousness.
The international community calls on Palestinians to use nonviolence to resolve their differences with the occupying power. That's nice advice, but the residents here at this funeral in Bilayin understand all too well that it just does not work. When they turn up to protest the separation barrier that divides this community, the Israeli response is clear: you may be killed.
31-year-old Farhan knew Bassem all his life, until the very end. They went to school together, and he was with him all the way to the hospitals where the doctors pronounced him dead. He understands the risks that go with nonviolent resistance, and he swears the escalation of force by Israel will not deter him.
The soldiers of the occupation army think that by killing the demonstrators, they can stop these protests. We will not stop until they return back our lands.
Israel has yet to tear down its barrier in Bilayin, even though the Israeli Supreme Court deemed its route is illegal. Just as Israel's apparent unwillingness to adhere to its own laws is nothing new, so too the Palestinian resilience, which no munition of any size has so far broken. Clayton Swisher, Al Jazeera, Bilayin, Occupied West Bank.
14-year-old Nashmi is inconsolable.
Standing at the door of Ramallah's government hospital, he struggles with the news that his cousin, 30-year-old Basim Abu Rahme, was killed by Israeli soldiers. During the weekly protest against Israel's separation wall in Belaein, west of Ramallah, eyewitnesses say Basim, who never missed a protest, was hit with what they say is a new type of rubber-coated tear gas canister at close range. Basim falls to the ground, the canister penetrating his chest cavity. He died on his way to hospital.
Basim was shouting at the soldiers, "We are here to protest peacefully. We have women and children and international activists." He barely finished his words when this new heavy canister hit his chest and left a hole in his chest.
Still dealing with the shock, activists show the camera the tear gas canister they say hit Basim, pointing to the bandage on his still chest. As ordinary Palestinians were living the grim daily reality of occupation, American peace envoy George Mitchell visited their president, Mahmoud Abbas, promising Palestinians statehood. Special envoy Mitchell met with the president for almost 2 hours. Though there was nothing new on the table at this stage, Palestinians might take heart from his unequivocal message.
The United States is committed to the establishment of a sovereign, independent Palestinian state, where the aspirations of the Palestinian people to control their own destiny are realized. We want the Arab Peace Initiative to be a part of the effort to reach this goal.
The Palestinians repeated their demand that Obama's administration oblige Israel to commit to the two-state solution and to stop all settlement expansion in the occupied West Bank, including occupied East Jerusalem. But were they promised concrete steps or a time frame for the resumption of peacemaking?
I'm not going to go into the details of the time frames or so on. All I can say is that Senator Mitchell said that this is the first meeting after the Israeli government came into office, and will be in a series of meetings with Israelis, Palestinians, Arabs, and others in the region in order to see to it that we move the Arab Peace Initiative forward and the two-state solution towards its realization.
Earlier on Friday, Israeli settlers shot and killed 17-year-old Rabah Hijazi south of Hebron. The settlers allege the boy broke into their settlement wielding a knife. Local sources contest this account, saying the boy could not have infiltrated the heavily guarded settlement. Palestinian leaders may have taken some encouragement from Mitchell's latest visit, but ordinary Palestinians have yet to see these words translated into actions. Nur Odi Al Jazeera, Ramallah.
And now we move over to the Gaza Strip in Palestine, where scores are orphaned in Israel's war on Gaza.
Every day, Ziad Abu Zayda watches the street in front of his home as his nephews make their way back from school. The three Bashir brothers are among the casualties of Israel's war on Gaza, a generation of Palestinian children orphaned by the brutal onslaught that killed approximately 1,400 men, women, and children.
There are about 2,200 children who have lost at least one parent because of the war.
Of these 2,200 children, at least 83 lost both parents, among them the Bashir brothers, whose mother, father, and eldest brother were killed by an Israeli airstrike in front of Saad's eyes. Since then, he, like Gaza, trying to rebuild itself since the war, has struggled.
I know that my personality is now different. I don't concentrate at school as much, and when I eat, I often think of them, and I start wondering about them.
The financial burden of adopting the three boys has fallen on the shoulders of their uncles, one of whom is Ziad. As orphans, the boys are entitled to nearly $2,600 in assistance from the deposed government in Gaza, but getting that money has been a challenge.
It's difficult because in addition to my family of seven, I now have to take care of the three boys, and I have been trying to get them their allowances, but no one has given us anything yet. There is always lots of support at the beginning, but the fates are away so quickly.
According to Islamic tradition, orphans are usually taken in by close relatives, but that sense of responsibility can create more problems for families already struggling to cope, says Dr. Hazem Sarraj, whose association coordinates the activities of charitable orphanages.
For most orphans and their families, when they do get the money, they are spending it immediately for cost living. This money is not used to secure the future of these children.
And the financial burden is often coupled with an emotional one.
My biggest challenge was how could I create a suitable environment for these boys to grow up in. I don't want them to feel any different to other children.
Creating a positive environment for the orphan children of Gaza amidst the rubble of war and Israel's siege is as difficult and uncertain as the future of those children. Ayman Mohiddin, Al Jazeera, Gaza.
And yes, you are listening to the World Weekly Review. My name is Skidmark Bob. We're going to break right now with a track from Midnight Oil, live from the Sound Relief Benefit Concert in Melbourne, Australia, 2009. Stay tuned. We got a lot more coming up.
The bloodwood and the desert oak hold a fraction by the diesel. Steven 45 degrees. The time has come to shave this fear, to pay the rent, to pay our share.
Yes, yes, that was Midnight Oil there with their hit Beds Are Burning from their March 14th Sound Relief Benefit concert out of Melbourne, Australia. Up next, we got our economics part of the show here. We're going to start off with a story from Al Jazeera. As this economic downturn gets worse, there are more home foreclosures, and we're going to hear about what a creative skater does in Fresno, California.
It's a new skateboarding destination. Skaters are coming from all across California. I caught up with Josh Peacock. He lives here in Fresno.
They're filming this for some news channel that's just as hated in the U.S. as I am.
Josh cruises the streets looking for empty houses with swimming pools. They're everywhere here. Summers are hot, many houses have pools, and many of those houses have been foreclosed by the bank. One ranking has Fresno as the city with the 12th highest foreclosure rate in the country.
Right. There's way more vacant houses now that the economy is so screwed up. There's an empty pool right there.
Josh is looking for the perfect pool, not to swim, but to skate.
Looks all right. I mean, he said a long time ago I probably would love to find this thing, but with how many pools we got going on now with the foreclosure, it's like you can pick and choose. All right, start driving.
The search continues, but it's not hard to find pools that fit their taste.
Perfect, like if it was made for skateboarding. This thing's so good, we have to drain it. Well, look at that. That thing looks good. Three houses back to back. So it just goes to show the screwed up economy in Fresno.
The choice is theirs, and they have their work cut out for them.
Got the pump here, extension cords, bucket. Some rags to dry up the slime.
Tools in hand, Josh and his friends are on a mission.
So we roll.
They drain it, bucket it, scrub it down, and sweep it.
Oh, there's a pool right there.
They're everywhere. Fresno.
Fresno is now a gold mine for Josh, and he has a very different view of the housing crisis.
The economy sucks for everyone, but I've always been poor, so I'm used to it. I'm not some yuppie that lost all my belongings, my house and stuff due to some financial crisis. I'm skating all these pools, and everyone else is hating life a lot worse than I am, that's for sure.
The only thing stopping them is an occasional trespassing violation. But the police usually just tell them to go away, and they just keep on skating.
For more information or to watch video of these news stories, visit the Al Jazeera English YouTube page or visit english.aljazeera.net. Up next, we have an interview from Flashpoints. Check out flashpoints.net. They broadcast on KPFA. This is off of the Best of Flashpoints. This is an interview with Catherine Austin Fitz about community businesses. Stay tuned.
We now continue with our regular economic segment called Community Business with Catherine Austin Fitz. Catherine, welcome to Flashpoints, and we are delighted to have you help us celebrate Pacifica on its 60th anniversary. And we will open up the phones in a few minutes for people who want to dialogue with you on a very special part of the bailout. But let me say welcome, and thank you for all your contributions, Catherine.
Happy birthday, Dennis.
It's close to my birthday, too. I was born within a few days of Pacifica. I wonder if there's a connection. Conspiracy theorists and all that. Well, we continue to do the work, and we're happy to have you with us. Let me read to you just a little bit, Catherine, off this, just ripped off the wire through the internet. This is from MarketWatch, and it goes something like this. Lloyd Blankenfein must be the luckiest guy on Wall Street. He leads one of the street's biggest, I love that, the street's biggest bailout firms. But unlike the other companies, propped up by the taxpayers, Blanken finds Goldman Sachs Group, Inc. is far more profitable, and it's poised to become a more influential force with greater market share. Different from American International, that's AIG, or Citigroup, Goldman hasn't had to forfeit any ownership stake in its firm, and its shareholders, many of them management and employees, have benefited. Wow. Goldman shares trade above 100 bucks. That's less than half of where Goldman shares traded at their peak, but far better than the $1 and $3 that AIG and Citigroup shares trade for, respectively. Wow. Goldman Sachs, what's your reaction?
Well, there's no doubt that Goldman has done a very profitable job of manipulating the government. Goldman has been the beneficiary of both government investment during the bailout and was the winner in the AIG bailout. The biggest chunk of money going through AIG went to Goldman Sachs for essentially insurance provided for some of this toxic paper. And it was Goldman that got, last year, there was an emergency effort by Treasury and the government to allow some of the investment banks to become holding companies so that they could use government guarantees in the form of FDIC insurance to access funding. And it's fair to say, Dennis, if it wasn't, and this was not just me speaking, it's the Wall Street Journal had a very interesting editorial today about Goldman Sachs. If it wasn't for the bailouts, I doubt Goldman Sachs would be in existence today. And yet Goldman Sachs says they just raised $5 billion of capital from stock sales, and they want to pay the government back so that they can continue to pay a very large number of employees, over $1 million a year.
They've also started paying a very high-powered law firm to make sure that nobody says anything terrible about them. Tell us about that. They're going after a blogger now, aren't they?
Yeah, they're going after. Apparently, they've hired, according to the reports, they've hired, I believe it's Chadburn Park, to go after a blogger who's going after them.
But they're going to sue him for 15 cents?
The top story on my blog is that Goldman Sachs amasses war chest. They've put together quite a cash store now, and it will be interesting. Many of the reports, I'm a member of a group called the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, and we try and lobby against and illuminate management of the precious metals market. And, of course, that always leads you into watching how the markets are managed. But our guess is Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase are the leaders on behalf of the government, probably of the Exchange Stabilization Fund, in really managing the markets. And, of course, if you have the inside information that you would get managing both stock and precious metals markets for the government, imagine how much money you can make.
And, of course, Goldman Sachs now, because they are doing so well, they are sort of reaching out, they're paying back their debts to the government, and they're going to help people. They're having community input.
Well, it's funny because as I told you, I'm on their alumni network because I was a summer employee once upon a time at Goldman Sachs. And, so I got my little email today, and as I'm reading about the various sort of manipulations of what they're up to, in comes the email saying that they're announcing their next round of community works programs. And
community works programs. What is it? Is that like Timothy Geithner gets a job?
I always feel at times like this, and I thought, I need to do something more positive today than that. I feel like writing and saying, when Goldman Sachs partners are in the vicinity at Mena, Arkansas, Maybe you should just stop, helping to rape Russia and stuff like that. Maybe that's what communities need you to do.
and they still hold sway in the government.
Let's look at who's who. I mean, the New York Fed is the mothership in the Federal Reserve System. That's where the greatest power lies. And the New York Fed is owned by its member banks, and presumably Goldman Sachs is one of them. So when you say the Fed, You know, it's not necessarily that different from Goldman Sachs. And now when you say Treasury, if you look at the who's been the Secretary of the Treasury and their sort of various relationships with Goldman Sachs, you know, one of my favorite quotes in the blog was from a taxi driver, I think is in Sumatra in Indonesia, saying, "What's the matter with your country? Why do you allow yourself to be run by Goldman Sachs?" Now, you know, if a taxi cab driver in the streets of Asia is asking that story, then certainly it's time for us to ask it as well.
And in terms of this citizen outreach, paying back the government, whose money are they paying us back with?
Well, you know, that's the $64,000 question, but let's just to say that one of the things that saved them was the ability to use the federal credit to basically, you know, issue insured CDs to raise capital. We're putting our money, you know, we as the taxpayers are giving a government guarantee, and then we as investors are giving our money, you know, in the form of CDs that we're attracting with our own guarantees, and that's financing all of this. So my guess is, you know, if you look at all the different people and institutions that have brokerage and other accounts with Goldman Sachs, you know, we're providing our money for this.
All right, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's the voice of Catherine Austin Fitz. And when you talk about the New York Fed, am I remembering correctly, but didn't they once offer you a job?
No, I was asked by the Secretary of the Treasury to be a governor of the Federal Reserve System. The Board of Governors in Washington, as you know, and when people hear about the chairman is the board of that governors, is a hybrid appointed by the president and with various approval, so it's a presidential appointee. So the Board of Governors is a hybrid. The individual banks around the country are owned by their members.
All right, let me tell people, this is Catherine Austin Fitz. She used to be the Assistant Secretary of Housing under the first Bush administration, and she is our advisor between Wall Street and Main Street. Catherine Austin Fitz, you want to communicate with her, solari.com/blog. Catherine, as always, we appreciate having you, and hopefully we'll be together 60 more years. And you take care.
Happy birthday, Dennis, to you and Pacifica.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. For hundreds of workers in Indianapolis, it took the patience of librarians to win a several years-long struggle for a union. Doug Cunningham reports.
When library workers at Indiana's Indianapolis Marion County Library decided they wanted to form a union, they couldn't just sign up to join one. It took them 4 years, but they won. They just signed their first collective bargaining agreement. With the help of AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, they first had to get the local library board to pass a resolution allowing it. Indiana law doesn't give public employees collective bargaining rights. AFSCME Council 62 Executive Director David Warwick says getting that board approval and organizing the workers took amazing perseverance by the 225 library workers.
The employees are very happy to have a voice now and a contract, and they're very excited about moving forward now with a document that allows them to have union representation and allows them to be able to sit at the table as equals. Without them doing this and sticking to the process, they would have ended up with nothing. They would have ended up with no raises and cutbacks in their insurance.
Warwick says in addition to concerns about wages and health insurance, the issue of respect and a voice on the job are what mattered most to these library workers.
The number of New Jersey state workers who could be laid off by Governor John Corzine if a furlough plan isn't accepted went up by 2,000 on Friday. Corzine had previously threatened to slash 7,000 jobs, but during an interview on radio station WOR, Corzine said he could cut as many as 9,000 positions. The governor has asked employee unions to convince members to accept 12 unpaid furlough days, essentially a pay cut, in addition to a wage freeze. The 100,000 workers are represented by six unions who are arguing in appellate court that in order for the furlough rule to be applied, the state needs to prove it is in imminent peril. The unions have already lost one round in the furlough battle in front of the Civil Service Commission, which refused to block Corzine's plan to implement one furlough day in May and one in June. The furloughs will impact many state institutions and close some departments, such as the DMV. Harley-Davidson announced on Thursday morning it would be cutting jobs company-wide. One plant that will be impacted in New York State is in York County. The plant, located in Springettsbury Township, has already been the victim of mass layoffs when Harley cut 249 positions in March. As a result of Thursday's announcement, an additional 90 jobs are expected to be slashed starting next week. Overall, the York County Harley plant employs nearly 2,500 workers. The Milwaukee, Wisconsin-based company saw first quarter income plummet 37%. Company-wide, Harley plans to slash 300 to 400 more hourly jobs on top of the 1,100 announced in January.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Up next is Dean Becker from drugtruth.net and his 420 Drug War News.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following comes to us from YouTube. Whoever captured it didn't tell me which network it came from. Looks like a cable show.
The president says no, but our next guest says yes. Judge James Gray, author of Why Our Drug Laws Have Failed and What We Can Do About It, joins us now. Judge, how do you say yes to this?
Well, Tom, it's really pretty straightforward. We were talking crystal balls a little while ago. My crystal ball is really clear. Our country will never be in better shape with regard to illegal marijuana until we regulate it, control it, and tax it for adults. It's the drug money that is really causing us troubles. And, all importantly, it makes marijuana less available for our children than it is today. Nobody offers our kids a free sample of Budweiser beer on their high school campuses, but it's happening all the time with regard to marijuana. Mm-hmm. So these are things that we simply need to address and change. We should treat marijuana like alcohol, tax it. We could generate a whole bunch of revenue for our states and really be in an awful lot better situation than we are today.
So
and that's
if you
not
do
even
it...
talking about then the Mexican violence going on today.
So, Judge, if you do it that way, then what are people using marijuana for? Is it used for the medicinal purposes, as many have argued in the state of California?
Well, certainly it should be used for medicinal purposes. But you know something? You could give this stuff away on the street corner and bless it by every religious leader in town. I'm not going to smoke marijuana, and I bet you aren't either, Alexis. But to be honest with you, if you would, you're probably smoking it already. It's fully available in any quantity you want. So let's regulate it, make sure that we have the purity controls through the FDA, and then tax it. Far less dangerous drug than alcohol, which I use pretty much regularly.
The tension point in the argument, though, about legalizing marijuana has always been, do you want to tax it so heavily that you tax it out of existence, or you keep it viable as an industry to keep the tax flow coming?
First of all, you have to reduce the price of marijuana so that you drive the illegal dealers out of business. No system is perfect, and I'm sure the children could get it just like they can now, but less so. You know something? Today, the illegal dealers of marijuana do not ask for ID, so it's easier for our young people to get marijuana than a six-pack of beer. So
yeah.
Where can we get better? Let's go to a regulated and controlled situation,
yeah, but
tax it, bring in that revenue, and go forward.
But, Judge, what Liz is bringing up is true. I mean, you know, we've got this crazy business where we subsidize tobacco, then we tax tobacco, then we start children's health programs.
Is there a difficulty that the government might want to increase their revenue by making deals on it? Yes, but it's our government. We're going to have to patrol that.
All right. Judge James Gray, great points, interesting points. Thanks so much.
Judge Gray is a member of my band of brothers, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, LEAP.cc, DeanBeckerDrugTruth.net.
That about does it for today's World Weekly Review. Tune in every Sunday at 1 p.m. on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101 FM, FreakRadio.org, or download the podcast at RadioForAll.net or Radio.IndieMedia.org. I'm your host and producer, Skidmark Bob. The theme song by Citizen Fish. The track's called Feeding. We're going out with it right now. Thanks for listening to the World Weekly Review.